Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Would You Data Scientist? I'm joined this week by James Edgell. He's a data science lead at Whitbread. How are you doing, James?
Hi, Wendy. Yeah, good, thanks. I was saying to you just now, the sun's out today in Oxford, which makes a massive difference. So, yeah, good today.
It does, right? Get that B12 in. Is it B12? Yeah, it's B12.
Steve.
All of it. Get all of it. So this week is Mental Health Awareness Week. So James and I are going to be talking a little bit about our experiences with mental health. But we'll get to that a little bit later on. So first up, James, what's your favourite piece of tech ever?
Yeah, I had a little think about this. My gut instinct was really, really boring. And it was, I was going to say smartphones. But I think if I was to dig in a little deeper, I would probably say for me personally, it was like iPods before smartphones, right? I'm massively into music. And
what's your favorite music?
I'm in an indie phase at the moment.
Okay.
But I go through phases. I think 6 months ago it would have been grime or drill, you know.
Love it.
Yeah. Changes all the time. But iPods. You know, I used to love the touch screen and all that when that came out. And then it obviously burst the iPhone, which then burst all the, you know, great smartphones we've got now. Obviously, Spotify's my favourite app. So yeah,
love
music,
it.
Music keeps going.
My daughter is the best playlist maker in the entire world. So I do music photography, and my music of choice is probably drum and bass. And nice. So she's been brought up with lots of different music, and she's like, I don't believe it. I remember her coming home from school once, and she went, Mum, listen to this song. And she played Original Nutter. I was like, what's going on? So I had an iPod, and I really, really wanted one. And when I left working at Alders, that's how long ago it was, in Basildon, the people who I worked with got me one as a leaving present, which was lovely. Really good. But again, Apple, as I said last week, they should sponsor me, because every week it's like everyone loves Apple.
They do good stuff.
They know what they're doing, right? So talk me through your career journey, your data science journey. How did you get into it?
Yeah, it's a fairly long story, if we've got time for it.
Got time.
I think, you know, simply put, it's sort of like my love for problem solving that led me here. So I'll go from the start. So, because I think, you know, I imagine your audience might include people potentially still at school, at uni and all that. So I think it might
definitely
be nice for them to hear the journey. So when I went to A levels, I was always had being a physics professor in mind. So, you know, it's my passion when I was about 16, 17. I did my A levels in physics, maths, and so on, chemistry, and went to study maths and physics at Warwick. And it was during my time at Warwick where I could see the academia research side that a lot of people went down. And it was quite grueling, long hours, you know, really, really competitive. And then you obviously had the other extreme of people who would, you know, want to go and chase money working in banking or so on. And there seemed to be like a middle ground where you could still use the academic, you know, research-based problem solving, as well as potentially chase a bit of money too. So I opted for the now evil industry of geophysics. So, you know, using physics, deterministic methods to extract oil. So I went and did a master's in that. And, you know, it was super interesting. But during my master's course, the price of oil fell from what was then, you know, over $100 to about $50 or something. The market basically dried up. There was no hiring. Everything was frozen. you know, we had BP, ExxonMobil and all these massive companies coming in to give talks to basically say, we're doing this talk, but sorry, we haven't got any jobs. So I was in quite a pickle. And I think it was during that time, I was like, okay, well, maybe I could go and do the research side of geophysics. Tried my best to do that, to secure a job in that sense after the master's. And what I did end up with was working in engineering geophysics, which, you know, is, you know, helping image subsurface when construction takes place. And, you know, that sounds really cool. I was doing seismic methods. I was doing GPR, electromagnetism and so on. It sounds amazing, right? But the reality was a lot of weekends, a lot of night shifts. I was in my early 20s. It wasn't ideal. And during all of this, you know, I was starting to learn more about databases. The term big data was itself exploding. I think it was like 2014 or 2015, where, you know, deep learning models were starting to get some traction, and cloud computing was on the rise. So I'd heard of this buzz term, and essentially I was like, right, time to pivot career. Not enjoying all this night shift work and weekend work. I really want to be doing problem solving all the time. I want to be using my statistical methods that I've been learning all these years. So I jumped in where I could and began as an analyst at Whitbread.
Okay.
Whitbread, for those who don't know, were Premier Inn hotels. They're about 850 or so in the UK. They're about 50 in Germany now. It was also Costa at that point, Costa Coffee, which I was
at. Yeah, of course it was. Yeah.
So we used to get free, you know, when I first joined, free Costa Coffees, like on demand. You could do the milkshakes and so on. We even had like a dedicated shop at the head office. But unfortunately that got sold to Coca-Cola a couple of years ago. Anyway, I digress. Joined Whitbread, started as an analyst, with always the intention to work my way towards data science. I've been officially a data scientist for almost a year now. But I've been doing data science for a lot longer, essentially 3+ years now. So yeah, that was my journey.
Brilliant. What kind of data science projects are you doing at Whitbread? Are you allowed to talk about that?
Yeah, I can do. So I think most people would assume that data science at Whitbread would be about optimizing how we sell our rooms, which obviously is a huge part of what the data science teams here are involved in. I particularly focus on customer data science and also contact center work. So in terms of customer data science, I do a lot of customer segmentation work and trying to predict how much our customers are going to spend so that we can then optimize our marketing activities. Which I love doing all of that sort of stuff. I love getting into putting a psychology frame of mind on and thinking about what makes customers tick.
Yeah.
And then the other part is the contact center work, where, you know, it's the sort of standard NLP stuff, where you have a complaint coming in, we get lots of complaints. just trying to understand what that complaint's about, to help the teams that pick up those complaints triage and work through those cases a lot faster. I'm getting to a point now where I'm starting to integrate some of the latest transformer models so that we can predict what the appropriate resolution should be in order to reattain that customer so that they don't churn after making a complaint. Sure. So it's really, I love it. I love NLP. I love customer data science, and yes, it's been a good place to grow.
Brilliant. I love that you love it. I mean, that makes that makes I know we haven't worked together, but that makes my job worthwhile, is when I get somebody a job that they love. Or I help somebody to be happy, like that makes my life. So let's talk a little bit about mental health then. Do you want to talk through a little bit about your experience? We had a phone call before we did the podcast. We're like, what should we chat about? And you said that you think it's really important to have this conversation. I completely agree with you.
Yeah,
go for it.
Yeah, sure. This, this, as we said, it's pretty uncanny timing that it's Mental Health Awareness Week.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah, so I felt that it was probably worth bringing up because, you know, in the past, it has been pretty difficult to talk about mental health problems and the setbacks that can cause. I could be wrong, but I think it's probably especially true for men as well. So, you know, hopefully it helps for someone to hear this stuff. But yeah, I've probably suffered with depression since I was a teenager. And going to uni was, it magnified what was already there. I think in my third year, so going into my final year of physics, basically a father figure when I was growing up passed away, which was a trigger for me to basically lose sight of what I was doing. And I felt like I was failing and so on. And I ended up basically saying to myself, well, I either carry on miserable and end up with a really, really bad result and I don't know what I'm doing with my life, or I take the year out, I take that time out and I, you know, rebuild and so on. And I think at the time, you know, I didn't know many people that would take those sorts of steps. This was in like 2012. So I took that year out, and obviously in terms of my peers that I'm with at the time, you know, I constantly think like, well, they didn't do it. They, you know, you can imagine we all do it. We compare ourselves to other people.
Yeah, 100%.
But it was, you know, I look back now, it's absolutely the right move. You know, I did that final year. I enjoyed my final year after taking that year out. I got a great result. You know, won an award while I was at university. I'd have never achieved that in the state that I was in before taking that year out. I think it's really important for people to hear that, you know, you can certainly succeed and more, even if you are to, you know, have a setback at any point because of your mental health. That was the first little bout.
Bless you. Thank you for sharing that. I think you've mentioned a couple of things that are quite poignant, and that is there's quite a bit of pressure for people to go to uni and do it the old-fashioned way, right? And from parents, from past teachers, from your peers, to go to uni and complete it, don't take a year out. It's kind of frowned upon, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
It doesn't mean you're a failure. Like my daughter's, she's in her second year of uni now. She's 22. She did an undergrad and then she took a year out. She definitely would not have been able to achieve what she's achieving now if she went like straight out of college.
No.
Definitely not. So yeah, thank you for sharing that. I think that's really important.
It's okay. I think everyone has a different, you know, points in life where they're going to peak or be able to perform at their best. And you know, it's the same with athletes, isn't it? Some athletes peak in their late 20s, some peak in their early 20s. I think it's, you know, somewhat similar for how you perform.
And then you get an injury, like, and then you can't perform properly.
Yeah, exactly. It is equivalent to an injury. So yeah, I think it's totally acceptable, and comparing yourself to other people is just not helpful. We don't do it. We don't do it for other, you know, other walks of life. We wouldn't say that to our friends. So why do we tell ourselves that we have to compare and be the same as everyone else? We've all got different backstories, haven't we? So
I've got so many whys. Why do we do this? Why do I look at myself in the mirror and like, why? Like, this. Do you know what I mean? Why do I? Okay, we're getting into it now. Why do I? I've done a lot of work on myself. Like I'm great. I'm a good person. Yeah, I'm kind and generous and all of the other stuff and hilarious. But why, when I start looking for a dating app, do I think that I am not good enough? It's just ridiculous, right?
Yeah, it's.
It's absolutely stupid.
The stories we tell ourselves.
So I've got a career coach, Kathy Brook, big up. I've had therapy. I'm on venlafaxine. That helps
me.
I am a little bit wobbly at the moment because of going through early menopause and my hormone levels are not quite right again, my HRT needs changing. Like, there's so many different things that can affect your mood and how you feel. And
yeah,
we were saying before, I said to you before that this Mental Health Awareness Week is about loneliness.
Yeah.
And I've put some posts out on LinkedIn about, oh, I'm so lonely. I even put the Team America, a Team America picture, probably wasn't very professional. Yeah, I'm really lonely. I'm living by myself for the first time, basically ever. Like, my daughter's moved out, I'm single. I've got the dog, Jimmy, but it's not the same. And, you know, I have had depression since I was at school, probably since, like, always. And it got worse with the menopause, but just before COVID was the worst it's been. Like, I could not get out of bed. I was burnt out from work. I had a not very understanding boss. I was going through all the hormone stuff. And thank God COVID came for me, because I was in bed for 6 months, just resting and repairing. And had that not happened, well, you know, who knows? Let's not think about that. But yeah, I was not in a good place. And my partner at the time was really supportive and wonderful. My daughter's always been great. But yes, I think it's really important to share our stories, because if it reaches one person, and anybody's going through this can reach out to me and I will talk to you. I'm going to put some resources in the show notes as well. Samaritans, there's a text service. There's also a charity called Ripple Suicide Prevention that Alice Hendy has founded. Sadly, she lost her brother to suicide, and she has made this fantastic add-on to Chrome, or, you know, I'm sure it goes on to other things. If somebody searches for anything of how to end their own life or anything like that, then if you've got this installed, and I urge everybody to get it installed, it pops up with lots of resources for you to contact. So yeah, I just wanted to give them a shout out because they're doing amazing things. They've won so many awards, and it's just really good to, it's from something so sad that Alice has come out with something so positive that's already saving people's lives. So I just wanted to give them a shout out, and I'll link those in the show notes as well.
Brilliant. I'll put that in my back pocket.
And breathe.
Yeah.
So
I was going to say, I just wanted to mention something else as well. You know, you touched on antidepressants. I think that's another, there's a little bit of stigma on taking antidepressants and stuff. I'm definitely aware of people who are like, oh, you take, I just should say, you know, people like myself, potentially someone like yourself, and there are a lot of people who genuinely do have a serotonin deficiency, right? And all these antidepressants are doing are just topping you up with what should be normal.
They're putting your brain cells there, they're reconnecting them the way they should. Yeah.
So like, you know, I also have a therapist, lucky me. You know, as she says, what's the point in functioning, you know, suboptimally without those antidepressants and beating yourself up because you're not working and being efficient and so on. You know, if you can just literally just take a small amount of a pill that you should have in your system anyway, you know, there's nothing to be ashamed of. It makes me able to function, it makes me happy, it makes me, you know, be able to be me. And
I think if you've got an iron deficiency, right? You take an iron tablet.
Yeah. So, you know, that in combination with, you know, a bit of therapy, and, you know, I've been into meditation for about 2.5-3 years now, and exercise, you know, if you've got those things, you're sorted. You are bringing, you know, helping your mental health to a huge extent.
Absolutely. And yeah,
I think you can always bring yourself out of the abyss.
But I mean, it's hard, right? So yeah. I first went on antidepressants when I had Emily. So that was Prozac 22 years ago. And, you know, they didn't have the antidepressants they had now. It's literally Prozac. And I was like, I'm the zombie. It wasn't postnatal depression. It was just depression. Right. But they just worked out that I had it. So that it must be because of the baby. And then I kind of stopped taking those. And I was having a hell of a time with her dad at the time. And I was like, I don't need this. There's nothing wrong with me. I can do it without. I am powerful, blah, 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 blah. And it wasn't until I had another horrible time with another partner that my daughter actually, like, she came out and she spoke about her problems and her issues. And she made me actually take my head out of the sand. There were so many reasons I didn't want to admit that I was depressed, right? One of the main ones was because other people were talking about their depression. I didn't want them to think that I was just jumping on the bandwagon. Like, how ridiculous is that? Like, it's so ridiculous. And, like, thank God for my daughter. She's absolutely amazing. Like, I wouldn't be here without her. But she's taught me so much about myself, and it's okay. There's nothing wrong with it. And that's why I want to talk about my problems, because she did that for me. I might be able to open that for somebody else.
Exactly. Yeah. That's why I'm pleased we've had this chat.
And therapy, right? I'm an Ivan. Therapy, right? Everybody should have therapy. I did a post on LinkedIn and it didn't go down very well, right? Because right. I said that I think therapy should be, you should have at least one chat with a therapist a year. You know, you have a checkup with your health, have a checkup with your mental health.
Yeah. That's a great point. Yeah.
And that should start in school, so that children are aware that they can talk about their feelings and that it's not a stigma, right? Every single yeah. I think I didn't write the post properly, or some people thought that I was saying that all kids need therapy. That's not what I'm saying at all. I'm just saying that once a year, talk to somebody about how you're feeling. And then if you're not feeling like you should, or you're struggling, then there could be some steps to take.
I've never heard that suggestion before. It's brilliant. Yeah, I think that would be great.
Yeah, and all it would be a GP appointment.
Yeah.
Let's do it. Come on.
Nice, let's make it happen.
So let's get back
to picket lines.
Yeah. Oh, it wouldn't be the first time. So let's get back to data science then. Okay. Because this is for people who are looking to get into data science, either pivoting like yourself or going for academia. So have you done any hiring as a data scientist?
Yeah, we've done a recent round of employment at Whitbread. So we've expanded our decision science function.
Perfect.
So we've done a bit of hiring.
So what do you look for in a candidate? What makes them stand out? What can our listeners do? Because, like, sexiest job, so many people applying for it. Like, what can they do to stand out?
I think demonstrating a passion for learning, for me, is a really, really big one, because data science is going to sound really cliche, but data science is a marathon. There is so much to learn in the landscape, and we're never going to be a pure expert unless you are in academia. Like, there is just too much out there, and there's always a new state of the art. There's always new cutting edge. So you need to be prepared to learn and relearn, and, you know, pivot to something new if a new technology comes along. So I think demonstrating your passion for what you're doing, why you're passionate about data science is really important. And then, obviously, you know, I work for a business, and so we're not just R&D in the back corner, you know, only surface every now and then. We're talking to our stakeholders. We present to C-suite sometimes. You know, you need to be able to get the business context of why your research and why your problem solving is important to the business. I think that's pretty hard to get the combination of those two things right. But if you see that combination, I think you're onto a winner.
Yep, yeah. Definitely. So do you think it's important for somebody to have a master's degree on that basis?
So this is a tricky one. I do and I don't. The reason that I do is because I know firsthand how useful some of the things that I was taught on my master's were for my professional career. For example, I was taught how to make a good PowerPoint presentation. I know that sounds really stupid, but it's so important in my professional life that I can make good slides and be able to communicate the science that I'm doing. And I don't think I got that undergraduate. Yes, I was, you know, there are a few communicating science sort of modules, but they really focus on that communication in a master's, which I think is really, really valuable. But that doesn't mean it can't be taught. You know, once you start a job, it's just a lot harder to get that exposure and experience if you haven't got a master's. But I mean, you can tell from what I'm saying there, I'm not saying you need a master's in data science. Like it probably doesn't really matter what your master's is in. It just gives you that exposure to presenting in a different way. But I definitely wouldn't use it as an indicator of whether to look at a candidate or not. I just think you just learn some really, really cool professional stuff when you're on a master's.
That's really interesting. That's a good way of looking at it. Thank you. So I mean, if you want to get a master's, don't get a master's. I think it's entirely personal. It's up to you. However you are, I mean, socioeconomic, I can't afford to get a master's. Simple as that. It's entirely up to you. It is a personal thing. There's no wrong or right answer there.
No.
What's your favourite data science project that you've ever done?
I kind of alluded to it earlier, actually. It's actually a project I'm working on right now, which is working with NLP. And it's the reason that I enjoy that project so much is because I can actually see how much a difference it actually makes to quote unquote, you know, the people on the ground. So you've got these lots and lots of customer contact agents who have to work through, you know, hundreds of complaints a day. And some of the stuff that's in these complaints can be pretty horrible and, you know, not nice. They have to work through them at extreme speed. You know, they've got their KPIs and so on. And I'm developing models that are essentially helping these guys work through their cases. It flags if something, you know, has really, really negative sentiment. So they're ready for that. It helps triage, you know, the easy cases for them versus the difficult ones. And yeah, I think it's nice to see that it's actually helping there. And then in terms of, like, you know, the selfish side of that, you know, I'm getting to work with really, really cool data science techniques and I'm learning every day that I'm, you know, implementing NLP. And yeah, it's a lot of fun.
I like that you can read the sentiment of the email and, like, pre-warn your colleagues if it's going to be like someone's going to be screaming at them.
We've created like a separate queue for those sorts of complaints where it's not like they're going to be prioritized per se, but it's like, you know, people are ready to take on those.
Someone with broad shoulders like myself is able to do it. Okay, that's cool.
Yeah.
So what do you think data science is going to look like in the future? I used to say, what do you think it's going to look like in 10 years? Then I said 5 years. Now it's just the future, because who can see, huh?
Yeah, everything's changing so quickly. I think it might go a similar way to how the oil industry was working when I was exposed to the software and so on when I was doing my master's. So essentially, you know, the oil industry has been doing data science since the 80s, 90s. It used to be a case where you get people sitting in a boardroom, throw a dart at the map on the room, and then they dig, you know, go extract the oil there. And then they used data science in the 80s, 90s and so on to optimize. And obviously the software that came with that over decades resulted in, when I was doing my master's, we were sort of, to an extent, quote unquote software monkeys, where we would, you know, follow a nice workflow, do the pre-processing, find the optimal parameters, build the model, and then that model would be interpreted and bang, go for that oil there. So I think you can see companies like Microsoft, Ada, you know, Amazon, Google, producing software all the time that is helping data scientists get to a workflow, you know, an end-to-end workflow. And I think we're just going to see the rise of GUIs and more people are doing, you know, these data science undergrads now. I think we'll get to a point where it is just a pretty standard part of a business where you work through these workflows and yeah, produce models that help the business.
So obviously
there are always going to be edge cases. There's always going to be state of the art as there was in oil. But I think the bulk of data science is going to become very much, you know, just a standard tool in a business's box.
So effectively it's going to get easier.
Yeah.
Do you think there's going to be less need for data scientists if it's more automated?
Yeah, data scientists in the sense of needing to know a bit of everything, you know, these jack of all trades data scientists. I think we're going to get more and more siloed. You're already seeing that to an extent already with the, let's just go through some of those definitions, data engineer, analytics engineer, data scientist, machine learning engineer,
decision
scientist, product data scientist. So we're starting to see that already. And I think it's going to get more. And I think another feedback loop that's involved is AI itself improving so much so that, you know, I've got GitHub Copilot, which I can just basically say what I would like my Python function to do. And it will use AI to spit out a function that works for my use case. So, you know, not that that's going to replace me, but it's definitely going to help me work faster and work better. And you'll just get people that are experienced with working with these AI tools. And
it's going to stop you from needing somebody to assist you.
Yeah. Just everything's going to become more streamlined, more just, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Less researchy than it is currently. And I think there will be a small pot of researchers who will just be working on state of the art. I could be wrong, but I think that's how the oil industry ended up. And I can see data science as having a lot of overlaps there.
Interesting stuff. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about diversity, which as a white male, I'm sure you understand your privilege, right? What have you seen? How is diversity looking within data science for you? How is it good?
Yeah, it's. I should say actually, this is funny that you. I'm the white male. I'm actually half Iranian.
Okay, so, there's me assuming that. I do apologize.
Yeah.
There's my bias coming in. I'm going to check that. Sorry.
No, that's fine. This plays into this conversation a little bit. I only started really associating with my Iranian heritage in the last like five, six years or so. I spent a lot of my time because I grew up in a very, you know, grew up in Kent in a very white working class area. So I didn't really want to be, I didn't want to be different, let's say. But obviously we know how important different characteristics are in contributing to a collaborative environment and producing AI that isn't biased and so on. So, you know, absolutely, we need to do our best to get people from diverse backgrounds into data science. Now that is a lot easier said than done. And from my experience so far, the pool of candidates does tend to be quite homogenous. But that is probably true for most industries in the UK, I imagine. Yeah. I don't think data science is unique there. I think the problem stems back all the way back to school, And, you know, I think we just need to do a lot more to encourage people into the sciences and into maths, and let people believe that they can do that. But yeah, it's difficult. We're quite lucky at Whitbread, actually, because we have a huge representation of women. You know, our male women ratio is great, and we do have people from probably better than most companies with in terms of diverse backgrounds. But yeah, there's so much to be improved. I think it has to go all the way back to schooling, to be honest.
Not even schooling, as you were saying, community.
Yeah. I didn't feel comfortable as someone young who was a bit different. So how do you make people like me feel more comfortable? I think there
you
are.
You don't
a lot
assume
of good
that
steps.
Somebody is a white male. I feel awful. Like, I know, but I'm the one preaching all the time and I've just done it. But we've all got our biases, we just need to check them. So here we are to the last question. And I always struggle to ask it because I still haven't updated my notes with how I should ask it. It still just asks about Elon Musk. So there are loads and loads, too many millionaires, billionaires in this world. Do you think that somewhere somebody is building an evil supervillain to take over the world? If so, how are we going to stop them? What punishment should they have?
Oh, man, that's a question. I mean, there are definitely evil supervillains in the world already, aren't there?
There certainly are.
There's something about Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos and so on that I think they get a little bit, it's not a hard rap, they've got so much money, but they are progressing humanity in the right direction, I think, you know, getting a company to put rockets on the moon at an economical cost.
Are you including Jeff Bezos in that?
Maybe not Jeff. I do think stuff like that is useful, but obviously what's not useful is the acts like Jeff Bezos does, the showmanship, how he treats his staff, the rest of it, and the obscene amount of wealth he's got. You know, I think Jeff and his wife split, didn't they? And his wife is now the biggest philanthropist in history.
Did she get like 2% or something ridiculous?
She got a lot of money, and she's been giving a lot of it away. And I think that should be anyone's punishment, right? Punishment in inverted commas. Like you could make philanthropy part of your mission for improving the earth, for improving humanity, bring everyone up to a better state. And like it does astound me that people are happy to sit on the wealth that they've got and watch people go to food banks and so on. Even their own employees at Amazon, I mean, come on, how can you allow that to happen when you're the richest person on the planet? How we've built a society to allow that to happen is probably the biggest point to make. Yeah, it's, you know, these individuals are just profiting from a pretty rubbish system that needs looking at. What can we do? just build a better society. And it's obviously very, very, very difficult to do that. But, you know, who we vote for has a big part to play in that.
Yes.
Be careful who you vote for.
Definitely.
...
So there's this guy on Instagram. He's called, his account is called Gary's Economics. He's called Gary Stevenson. And I want every single person who's listening to this to go on his account and have a look, right? He is an equality economist. He used to be a trader and he is a millionaire, right? He's super, super rich, but he used to make predictions and was right all the time, okay? And he explains how he did that. But now he's explaining about the government debt, working classes, making millionaires what they're getting on interest rates, what we can do. So everybody, please go and have a look at it. It's so super interesting to find out just how crooked people are, and how money works in the economy. I'll link that in the show notes as well.
That sounds interesting.
It's really interesting. Like, some of his videos are long. Like, he's like a Cockney geezer as well. Like, he's really relatable. His story is really interesting, and I really like the way that he's just like outing the government and outing the rich people. It's good. Yeah. Anyway, nice. Have you got anything before we go that you would like to plug or talk about?
I don't know. I just wanted to say, you know, thank you for having me and you know, wanting to hear my thoughts on things. And I'm just pleased that I've been able to share a little bit on mental health.
You have been an absolute delight, James. Thank you very much for coming on.
Cheers, Wendy. Thanks for having me. Oh,